From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. Robin and Jeremy are off. It's Here and Now. This is the 3rd of July, and most politicians have cleared out of Washington for the holiday tomorrow. President Trump doesn't have too much downtime, though. On Thursday, he's going to be heading to Poland to address world leaders at the Three Seas Conference. And then he'll attend the G20 summit in Germany and meet with the presidents of China, Japan, Mexico, and with Vladimir Putin of Russia. Even with that heavy agenda, the president has still found time to tweet. This morning, he sent out a flurry of tweets about his phone calls to world leaders. This past weekend, though, his Twitter topic of choice was the media. He posted a doctored video of him nailing to the ground someone labeled CNN. That tweet brought a barrage of criticism from the left and from the right, but not from people such as the Homeland Security advisor Tom Bossert. On ABC's This Week yesterday, Bossert defended Trump's tweets, slapping down the media.
He needs to go around you and the producers that control the message and directly to the people and whatever he cares about speaking about that day. And occasionally he cares to speak about those cable programs that are beating up on him unfairly.
Joining us now to make sense of this is NPR political reporter Jessica Taylor. Hey, Jessica.
Hi, Lisa.
The president tweeted that he won the 2016 election with interviews, speeches, and with social media. How do Americans feel about Mr. Trump's use of social media?
Well, we asked this question actually last week in an NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll that we did, and an overwhelming 69% of Americans said that they found his tweeting reckless and distracting. Only 21% found it was effective and informative. And even among Republicans, that number is pretty split. Most of them did not like his sort of use of this. And I can just say, you know, I've traveled around the country this year talking to voters, and one of the things I've heard from them is that they wish that he would, you know, stop tweeting things like this. I think that if he were using his platform to talk about policies or even, you know, people will say he can punch back a little bit, but when he sort of, you know, focuses in on this sort of so myopically, I think that a lot of things, other things are getting distracted. He's getting distracted from the issues.
The poll also tracked public trust in the Trump administration and in the press and other institutions, too. Could you break down the results for us?
Well, I think that his Twitter has a lot to do with this. We found that 7 in 10 Americans say the level of civility in Washington has gotten worse since President Trump was elected. And just 6% say the overall tone in the nation's capital and across the country has improved. And certainly his tweets like this don't help things like that. You know, and that's pretty standard across the board, too, even among Republicans. And, you know, comparatively, 8 years ago, a Gallup survey asked this question, and only 21% of Americans in that poll thought that civility had declined after President Obama was elected.
I wonder what Republicans on the Hill say publicly and if you know, privately.
Well, you know, when his sort of Twitter tirade began last week, when he goes off on the media, obviously calls us fake news and different things, too. But when he gets into these deeply personal tweets and especially attacking someone's looks or things like that, too, that's where you have seen members of Congress and politicians sort of come out really sort of denouncing this. And when he did this last week against MSNBC host Mika Brzezinski, saying, you know, when she tried to get him on there, she was bleeding from a facelift and different things, too. You really did see politicians and Republicans on the Hill come out and say this. And that's because what should he have been talking about that day? What did they want him to be talking about? It was the health care bill. And there were two GOP women that really came out and condemned this, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Susan Collins of Maine. And those are two critical votes he needs on health care, too. So doing this against a female journalist as well certainly is not doing much to sort of get them on his side on other issues as well.
So he is accused of doing what you were talking about there, and that is using social media in an inflammatory and provocative way to distract from other issues on the agenda. What are those most pressing issues right now?
Well, healthcare right now, because you have this bill in the Republican Senate that is really on life support because they can only afford to lose two votes and in order for it to pass in the way that they are trying to pass this through reconciliation. And you have a bill that came out that was largely written in secret that could throw millions of people off healthcare in 10 years. And they haven't really got the support behind it. You have a conservative wing that thinks that it doesn't go far enough. You have a moderate wing that is concerned about the number of people that it would kick off Medicaid in their states. And, you know, there's really not been a push for we haven't seen a way forward in consensus. That's why last week they wanted to vote on this bill before they left to go home for the July 4th holiday. They were unable to do that because if they'd have put that bill forward, it would have failed. And so he's not talking about health care. And actually, did you know last week was supposed to have been energy week? They were supposed to be talking about renewable energy policies and different things, too. Didn't see that on Trump's Twitter feed either, really at all.
Give us one more. Not that those those two aren't huge enough, but one more quickly.
Well, he wants to talk about tax reform, too. You know, he's mentioned this sort of intermittently. He wants to, you know, push through some tax reform policy. So, you know, when he says that the media isn't talking enough about policy and different things, too, you look at his Twitter feed, it's a snapshot of it. It's him attacking the media. I think if he were out there, you know, talking more about some of his specific policy ideas, I think, you know, most of us would be more than happy to cover things like that.
NPR political reporter Jessica Taylor, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the number of minority-owned businesses has grown to about a third of all businesses in the United States. But startups for blacks and Latinos also have higher failure rates. And economists say one big reason is they have less access to federally backed loans from big banks. Farida Javala Romero from Here and Now contributor KQED reports on some of the challenges facing minority business owners in California.
And rolling in one, two.
Hello and welcome to All About Community. My name is Robert.
Leonard Stevens has run a television production business in Oakland for 13 years. His shows air on two Bay Area cable channels, and he sees potential for his network, RTV, to go national, even global. Its online streaming numbers show it, he says.
People are watching us all over the world. I was looking at the analytics yesterday.
To expand, Stevens is applying for a small business administration loan, $500,000. A bank has to provide the loan, but the federal SBA guarantees up to 85% of the amount in case the borrower can't pay back. That's why Stevens believes the bank might be more willing to take a chance on his business.
So the bank has a very low risk in terms of them losing any money.
If he succeeds, he'll be a rarity. The SBA guaranteed more than $5 billion last year in California, but African Americans were just 2% of those borrowers. Latinos were 13%, even though they own close to a quarter of all the businesses in the state. The tiny percentage of minority loans is not a good sign for the U.S. economy, says Alicia Robb, an economist with the University of Colorado.
Minority businesses are a growing share of our business community and, you know, as our population. And so we need to ensure, because they're lower wealth levels, they're more reliant on credit. We need to ensure that credit markets are working for them.
Rob has found that blacks and Latinos apply less than white Americans for bank loans for fear of rejection. And then there's this fact from multiple studies. When those minority business owners do apply, they get rejected more than equally creditworthy white-owned firms.
That's why we need the government to really focus on these huge gaps that we see in the market.
Mark Quinn directs the SBA for Northern California. He says the Great Recession left African Americans and Latinos farther behind. Those communities lost much of their wealth. People who lost their homes also lost collateral to apply for business loans.
Certainly before the Great Recession, SBA had a higher share of our lending to African American and Latino businesses. What we saw then after the Great Recession was a couple of really negative factors. Low-income communities had their credit scores affected. Lenders became more conservative. Regulators told lenders that they wanted to see more cautious lending.
Quinn says the SBA started a pilot program in 2011 to reach underserved communities. It's called Community Advantage, offering loans up to $250,000. Those SBA-backed dollars don't go through big banks.
You can't really get the large for-profit lenders to really see that it's profitable to do lots of small loans. That's why we really look to the nonprofit world to be our real avenue to get into some of the communities we can't get to from some of the national banks.
The program is still just a pilot. Quinn says it's been hard to ramp up Community Advantage and other microlending SBA programs because nonprofit lenders have less capacity than banks, so there's fewer loans going out. But for the small business owners who are successful in getting those dollars, it can make a huge difference.
Woohoo!
That's how Dominica Rice opened her restaurant Cosecha in Oakland.
We've been here, this July will be 6 years.
Rice saw others in her family open businesses that didn't work out, so she was very cautious.
So I took around almost 5 years of interviewing people who I've known and worked with who own restaurants, and I asked them every question.
She was mentored and saved money, and then found a local nonprofit lender that helped her figure out how to make her menu cost-effective and guided her through the loan application process.
And the applications are daunting. And tell them, like, I'm a dyslexic Chicana from L.A. I was very forthcoming. I'm like, this is not my thing. I'm not the person who's on the computer doing a ton of research. I am the person who climbs a mountain in Oaxaca to meet a señora who makes mole. That's who I am.
And that mole sauce is popular. There's a long line of customers here daily. Rice has already repaid her $35,000 loan. Our other borrower, Leonard Stevens, he decided to go a different route. He hired brokers to help him prepare his SBA loan application.
The brokers are there to utilize some of the banks or financial institutions that they've worked with before that they have a good relationship with.
The brokers advise Stevens to hire an accountant to put his media company's balance sheets in order and do cash flow projections for the bank.
And you should come back and talk to me in a few weeks, and then I'll have a bigger perspective and hopefully a bigger smile on my face by then. I've invested a lot of money in these brokers.
Stevens has paid about $30,000 total to the brokers and the accountant just to apply. He just hopes it's worth it. For Here and Now, I'm Farida Javala Romero in Oakland.
If you head to the supermarket to buy some appetizers, you'll notice that some mighty fancy cheeses are crowding the dairy aisle these days. In many parts of the country, small farms are diversifying and offering up new varieties. Amy Mayer of Here and Now contributor Harvest Public Media traveled to rural Iowa to find out what's behind the artisan cheese boom.
Come on. I see some movement in this direction.
Kevin Dietzel is calling for the cows to come home here at Lost Lake Farm near Jewell, Iowa. He'd always been interested in dairy farming, but when he finally decided to give it a go, he found himself here in central Iowa, where fertile cropland is expensive and dairy herds are few. Milk prices are notoriously unstable but reliably low, meaning most dairy farms need to make money on volume. Dietzel knew his farm would always be small, so he took a different tack.
My business plan for that was to add value to that milk by making cheese.
Which explains this building. It has a milking parlor on one end and, through a separate entrance, a near-sterile-looking room filled with stainless steel and food-grade plastic. Dietzel trades his warm hat and coat for a hairnet and apron and gets to work massaging curds into a wheel of cheese that's hung in a plastic mesh bag in the climate-controlled cheese cave, or storage area. Dietzel's signature product is Ingrid's Pride, made using his own technique and featuring a unique flavor related to the grasses his cows eat. Dietzel's handmade small-batch processing means he can sell his cheese for more than a big company like Kraft or Cabot.
That means we have to do something that's a little bit more original and is also going to be worth that money, so hopefully we're doing that.
Dietzel is part of a growing number of Midwest dairy operators choosing smaller herds and on-farm processing. Iowa State University dairy scientist Stephanie Clark says in her 7 years here, she's seen about 1 to 2 new startups a year make the investment in cheese.
It's amazing the history that we have in Iowa on its own. And then we have quite a lot of success throughout the Midwest.
The math can make sense. With a back-of-the-envelope calculation, Clark says one cow's milk might yield a farmer $13 a day. Turning that milk to cheese, she says, could gross $105.
We are talking about specialty cheese. We're talking about smaller farms. Can be artisan, can be farmstead.
Any place making cheese on the same site where the cows are raised and milked. Obviously, there are expenses beyond what a milk-only dairy has. But these small, all-in-one businesses hope to make money with cheeses that fetch a premium price, as long as they have a market. The cheese shop here in Des Moines opened 5 years ago. Owner C.J. Bienert combs the Midwest for the best varieties, even stocking a small amount of an apple cider washed rarity from Michigan's Upper Peninsula that he sells for $50 a pound. It's the ultimate local foodie indulgence.
But it sells. You buy a tenth of a pound, you know, $5 worth, a very small little taste, and it's a treat.
Many of Bienert's other options are still special, but more reasonable. Right now, he says about 70% of the cheeses in the shop are domestic.
I really do believe in the next 5 years, we'll be able to be 80 to 90% American artisan, and we'll have at least a half a dozen, if not a dozen more producers here in Iowa.
Bienert also features cheeses from Missouri, Nebraska, Colorado, and other regions of the country. A simple cheese-centric menu attracts a lunch crowd.
I'm a big blue cheese fan, but anything soft and stinky is what I like.
That's Cassie Valick, a customer from nearby Newton, Iowa.
I like the Prairie Breeze cheddar. I think those are probably my two favorites. I'm fairly new to Iowa, so I like to get out and explore and try all of the options here.
She's just the kind of customer who may help encourage other small, creative dairy farmers to work with their milk until they can sell it as cheese. For Here and Now, I'm Amy Mayer.
Communities across the country will celebrate Independence Day tomorrow, chief among them, Philadelphia. That's where the Continental Congress adopted the Declaration of Independence on July 4, 1776. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock made a recent road trip to Philadelphia, and he spoke with Adam Duncan, a National Park Service ranger at Independence Hall, where the founding fathers made the history we're still celebrating 241 years later.
This is Independence Square, what would have been called the Pennsylvania State House Yard. It is the colonial capital for the colony and also the state of Pennsylvania. And then later, it gets borrowed in the summer of 1776, not just by the Continental Congress, which would pass the resolution for independence and sign the document, but also it would be home to the Constitutional Convention 11 years later in 1787.
And just remind listeners what was going on in Independence Hall at around this time, July 1776.
Early July, really specifically July 1st, if we were to walk into the building and go back in time to that historic year, we would find debates taking place on the floor of the Continental Congress, mostly between John Adams and John Dickinson, debating the resolution for independence. That actually passes on July 2nd of 1776, a day that John Adams thought would be celebrated. He writes his wife the next day, Abigail, and he tells her that the day will be celebrated for forever, really, to paraphrase him. So after the 2nd, after independence passes the resolution, they now pull out Thomas Jefferson's rough draft of the Declaration of Independence. What was written between a time period of June 11th to June 28th is when Jefferson worked on it. And they're going word by word, ultimately being the editors of the document. They make about 80 changes, one very substantial change. They delete the passage that Thomas Jefferson pens, accusing King George III of being, and really indicting him for being responsible for the slave trade here in North America. And that was taken out. So in the afternoon of July 4th, the delegates of the Continental Congress actually vote to adopt the final written edition of the Declaration of Independence. That's about it. I know people are expecting, well, when did they sign it? That would actually take place on July 4th, despite popular belief. The signing ceremony took place in August 2nd, 1776. Never at one time were they all there in this momentous occasion, all penning their names. We think about 50 were there August 2nd after a formal copy was handwritten out. That process takes time, hiring a calligrapher, so it wasn't immediately done on July 4th. So it's not ready for them until August 2nd. They add their names, and then about five or six others actually add their names years after the fact, all the way up into 1781 when we believe Thomas McCain of Delaware added his signature.
So everyone celebrates on the 4th of July now. You mentioned that John Adams thought the 2nd was the bigger day. But what happened in Philadelphia in the days after the Declaration of Independence was issued?
Sure. The days after, the citizens of Philadelphia certainly would have been the first to know, obviously, because their proximity here in the city. It was not kept a secret. And they ordered prints the evening of July 4th so they could be distributed, sent out throughout the new states, and have public readings. And that would take place in the preceding days. One copy was dispatched to George Washington in New York to read to the troops. He read his on July 9th. And that celebration would kind of go throughout the new nation as word is received about American independence.
Are you from Philadelphia?
I'm from Wilmington, Delaware.
What does this history mean to you personally, just to be from this region and have this birth of a nation having happened in your region?
On a personal note, I find very strong connections in my personal life with the history of this place. Unbeknownst to me, at the one time, I worked for the Bank of New York, which would become Alexander Hamilton's bank. I lived in an apartment complex in Conshohocken next to an old lake. It's called Sherry Lake. When I got this job, and that was in college, when I got this job just after I graduated school, I started doing research, and that is where they actually got the stones for Independence Hall. So I have a lot of just personal, really ironic connections that I didn't even know at the time when it was happening. And it's such a fantastic city. Philadelphia, we're a World Heritage City, the only one in the United States. We get visitors from all over the place. And it's just fantastic to have this story here in Philadelphia to tell the beginnings of our nation. It's such an exceptional experience.
What's it like to be here on 4th of July?
It's pretty neat. It's pretty neat. Especially having been in the room telling the story on July 4th to our visitors. We don't require tickets to visit. You just line up. So people will be waiting in line for hours to go into the room where it actually happened. And I kind of take a minute. I make everybody be quiet for a second, and I let them soak it in, because you can really feel the connection, especially in that room on that day. It's phenomenal. And I think our visitors really have that sense, that presence, and the patriotism when they come and visit.
Adam Duncan is a National Park Service ranger at Independence Hall in Philadelphia. He spoke with Here and Now's Alex Ashlock. Our road trip to Philadelphia continues tomorrow with a visit to the new Museum of the American Revolution.
What we're trying to do is show people that history is not a settled thing. It's open for question. It's up to the visitor to find their answers to those questions along our path.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions, and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle. And it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first three meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
This week will be a very busy one for travel in the United States. Part of the reason, gas prices started the summer at a 12-year low. And the industry trade group Airlines for America predicts a record number of air passengers this summer, 234 million, up 4% from last year. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hey, Jill.
Hello.
Hey, so why are so many people traveling? You know, gas prices are low, but that wouldn't really explain why so many people are flying, would it?
No, but it sort of will give you a little bit of a clue that it is affordable. And we know that airfare is actually the 40 most traveled routes in the U.S. are actually down a touch, about 10%, according to AAA Travel Services. But this may say more just about where we are, in that it does feel a bit like people feel that the economy is good enough. I don't have to worry that if I'm not there, I'm going to lose my job. And I do think Americans have really foregone so much vacation time over the last 6, 7, 8 years, that there's been some pent-up demand. So we're seeing a robust travel season. That's good news for the industry.
So a sign that the economy may be doing pretty well, but people may be stuck in airports, stuck on airplanes. There have been so many high-profile incidents lately. Do you think the airlines are going to be prepared for all this traffic?
It almost doesn't matter, because consider this. How else are you going to get from one place to the other, especially if you go over an ocean?
Yeah.
And if anything, what has happened in my experience, and when I hear from people about travel experience, is that everybody just is conditioned to wait, and you're expecting this. We also know there's lots of airline competition, and that competition, it's not as if it's raising the bar. It lowers the bar for comfort level, because the cheapest fares are for these teeny tiny narrow seats. And again, if you want to get there efficiently, chances are you're going to have to fly if you're going some distance.
What about these gas prices? They haven't been this low at this time of year in more than a decade. The price of oil fell back into bear territory in June. What's going on there?
Well, at the beginning of the year, there were lots of conversations around oil's going to come back. And it did. It rose. And there were a lot of crude oil traders who were very excited about this. And I remember talking to folks, and they were saying, oh, it's 50, 60. We see $60 oil. Well, guess what? Despite a lot of the OPEC nations getting together and trying to limit production, the globe is awash in petroleum. And frankly, there's so much oil going around that it has pushed crude down by nearly 20%. We just finished the biggest first half slide for crude oil in two decades.
Finally, I want to ask you about President Trump's revised travel ban that partially went into effect last week. Also, we have new security screening measures at U.S. airports. Will any of that have an effect on summer travel?
Well, I don't think it's going to have an effect right this minute because most people have booked already. But, you know, I have often will interview Peter Greenberg, who's a CBS News travel editor, and he'll always extol the virtues of, oh, you, people should be going by train. People should be road tripping. But again, at the end of the day, if you want to bring your family on some fabulous trip and you need to get there quickly and efficiently, you're stuck dealing with the revolting idea of air travel. And yeah, honestly, it's just not fun. People are girding for it, but they're hopefully rewarded by a great trip down the line.
All right, Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thanks as always for joining us.
Great to be with you.
We've entered prime vacation season with a 4th of July holiday, and we could keep our noses in the smartphone, we could keep feeding the social media beast, but why when Petra Mayer of NPR Books has such good book recommendations for us? Welcome, Petra.
Hi, happy to be here.
I know that you've got on your list a light summer romp about murder. What would summer be without a murder mystery?
Yes, absolutely. This is Magpie Murders by Anthony Horowitz. And you might know that name because he is kind of the master of the genteel British TV crime drama. He had a hand in both Midsummer Murders and Foyle's War, which is like the go-to comfort TV for a lot of people I know. So if that is your jam, you should definitely check this out. It's about a book editor, and she has to work with a famous author of these kind of very formulaic country house cozy village kind of mysteries, and he's a weirdo, but he sells so well.
Even better.
Yeah, he sells so well that she has to put up with him. But then she gets his latest manuscript, and she's reading it, and she starts to read between the lines, and she starts to figure out that there's some subtext there that might be sinister. So it's a lot of fun. If British crime is your jam, you should definitely pick it up.
And what about for history buffs, historical novels?
Ah, yes. I've been reading The Essex Serpent by Sarah Perry. Again, this is set in the UK, in England. It's set at the end of the 19th century. It's about a woman who her domineering, oppressive husband has just died, and she is just tired of Victorian London stifling society. She's very much involved in the naturalist movements that were really big around the second half of the 19th century in England. She just wants to get out and hunt fossils on the moors or in the marshes, because she goes to Essex, to a little village in kind of marshy wetlands, and she just wants to sort of go around in nature. And there's just beautiful naturalist writing in this book, if you like. And it's a landscape that isn't normally kind of appealing, these sort of marshes and, you know, bleak, windswept, salty part of England. But she just finds so much joy in it that you go along with her. And in this area where she is looking for fossils, there's a myth of a water monster, a serpent, that was last seen in the 17th century. And now people feel like they're seeing it again. And it plays into kind of the conflicts of faith and science that were going on at that point. Do you believe in the monster? Do you not? What does it mean? It's a beautiful summer, a historical novel with a lot of depth to it, and just gorgeous writing.
A novel that spins off a classic literary tale is on your list. This sounds particularly interesting. Tell us more about it.
Yeah, I've been on a kick this year of reading women authors who are reworking classic literary monster myths. And so the latest one that I've read is The Strange Case of the Alchemist's Daughter by Theodora Goss. And it starts with Mary Jekyll, who is the daughter, of course, of Dr. Jekyll. And her father has disappeared. Her mother has just died. She's basically penniless, all alone in this big crumbling house, you know, with the relics of her high society life around her. And she starts investigating. She wants to figure out what was going on with her father, his mysterious friend, Mr. Hyde, for whom there is a reward. So she wants the money. She starts looking for Hyde because she needs the money. And along the way, she runs into a group of other women who all turn out to be the daughters of famously sinister scientists. And of course, these sinister scientists are up to no good, and they have to sort of uncover the secret of what was going on. And it's also wonderfully inventive. Like, the women in the book all kind of, they interrupt the narrative now and then as a Greek chorus, sort of commenting on the one of them who's been chosen to write the story, kind of a la The Breakfast Club, but the rest of them keep chiming in and commenting on how she's writing it. So, yeah, it's inventively written. It has wonderful characters. If you are a fan of taking classic mythologies and reworking them, this is definitely a fun read.
Okay, again, that's the Strange Case of the Alchemist's Daughter. You got a nice summer romance on your list?
Absolutely. I feel like I'm kind of my Anglophilia is showing here, because this is a series called London Celebrities. The most recent one is called Pretty Face. I love romance. Let's just put that right out there. I think people who know me know that. I don't generally like contemporary romance, but this sucked me in. It's set in the London theater world. It's about an actress who is amazingly named Lily Lamprey, and she's kind of a over-sexualized, dismissed as talentless TV actress, and she gets a part in a super prestigious theatrical production with a really big name director. And of course, he hates her on sight and sparks fly, but she's really, truly talented. And both of them have lots of growing to do. And of course, there's a happy ever after, like all good romances. And it's just a lot of fun.
There is something, and we should tell our listeners, we're going to have a full list on our website. You got a book on the more serious side you want to mention.
Yes, What We Lose by Zinzi Clemens. It's a quick read. It's a lot of short vignettes, a couple of pictures, but it's definitely not an easy read. Zinzi Clemens works a lot of her personal experiences into the story, which is about a young African-American woman who's dealing with intense grief after the death of her mother and sort of all the strange connections that that brings into her life, the links that she sees between grief and desire, the way that her mother is from South Africa, so the way that that history and culture mixes and sort of clashes sometimes with her father, who's American, and how she feels about that intersection, the way she feels about her relatively light skin and how it affects her relationships with darker skinned women in particular. And the writing is, again, the writing is just gorgeous. That's kind of been a theme for me this summer. And I think what really brought it home for me was just the way that she's writing about this very particular experience, a very specific person and a very specific set of experiences. But when you're reading it, it resonates in your heart. You know, when I was reading her writing about grief, and I was thinking, you know, this is really striking a chord, and I think it will strike a chord with all kinds of readers. So if you want some more emotional heft in your summer reading, this is a great choice.
And you also want to end with a sneak preview, I know. A couple books that aren't out yet, but you thought you should mention them just to give people a heads up.
Yeah, absolutely. So going back to my theme about women authors reworking classic mythologies, there's a book out at the end of July called Strange Practice by Vivian Shaw, which I just found utterly delightful. It is about the granddaughter of Dr. Van Helsing from the Dracula books, Greta Helsing, and she's a doctor in modern-day London who tends to the supernatural community there. So she's like, you know, curing ear infections and baby ghouls and all kinds of things like that, just as a general GP. For all the creepy crawlies, and she gets drawn into a supernatural plot, and there's like every literary vampire you can think of is in this book, and the way that they all mix and meld is so much fun. And then the final volume in N.K. Jemisin's Broken Earth trilogy is out in August. The first volume, the fifth season, won the Hugo Award in 2016 for best novel. This is an amazing, powerful, gorgeously written fantasy series about a world that suffers continual geological upheavals, and the caste system that's developed in this world between the people who can control the earth and the people who control the people who control the earth. The last one's called The Stone Sky. It's out in August. I highly recommend everything she has ever written, but this one's coming out in August, and you should go read it.
Petra, before we let you go, we want to ask you about NPR's Summer Readers Poll, which is asking listeners about their favorite comics and graphic novels. What's up with the genre that you're focusing on that?
Yeah, this is going to be so fun. This is the Summer Reader Polls we do every couple of years. The last one was romance a couple years ago. This year, I thought, why not comics and graphic novels? Because, well, I'm a giant nerd. I love comics. But it's also, there's so much good work out there right now that, I mean, it's an incredible time to be a comics fan. There's so many young creators coming up. There's so much classic material to read. There's interesting things happening with web comics. So what we did was we polled our readers. We had 7,500 nominations. People wrote in about all their favorite comics. Mm-hmm. We sent it to an expert panel, including some really amazing people, our comics critics, Glenn Weldon and Atelka Lahotsky, Spike Trotman, a publisher with Iron Circus, who does amazing work, Maggie Thompson, who is Stephen Thompson of Pop Culture Happy Hour fame. His mother, she's a big name in comics, was an Eisner Award judge a couple years ago, and G. Willow Wilson, the current writer of Ms. Marvel. And together, all of us talked through these, you know, hundreds and hundreds of submissions and came up with a really great list of 100 comics that we think people will enjoy. That list will go live next Wednesday. That's the 12th of July, just ahead of San Diego Comic-Con, for all you nerds out there. And we think people will find lots to read and enjoy.
We've got a link to NPR's Summer Readers Poll at hereandnow.org and a list of all of Petra Mayer's book picks. Petra Mayer of NPR Books, thanks so much and happy 4th.
Thank you. Happy reading.
The Wimbledon Tennis Championship gets underway today at the All England Club. Defending men's singles champion Andy Murray opened the tournament on center court and defeated his opponent in 3 quick sets. This year marks the 131st year of Wimbledon, and 90 years ago, radio commentary at the tournament began. The BBC had the honors back then. It still does. Joining us now is Robert Cedar, the BBC's historian. Robert, welcome.
Thank you.
Take us back to that day, 90 years ago, June 29th, 1927. How significant was it?
Well, radio was just the big passion of the 20s and 30s, because imagine you've moved from a world where you were completely unconnected to suddenly at the switch of a button, you could have everything: music, news, children's programs and sport. And sport, of course, is the great motivator that brings people together. And what the BBC wanted to do was give you that ringside view, that ringside seat. So sport was a big, big motivator. And 1927, which is 5 years after the creation of the BBC itself, is a really important year for sport, because for the first time, believe it or not, you could actually have a complete running commentary of a sport. So in this year, everybody piles in with the sport fixtures. And of course, everybody wants Wimbledon, and it is a big moment.
But there is no broadcast left in the archives. What happened to that?
No, because it was really considered as an ephemeral art, really. Nobody thought that years later we'd be sitting in America, you know, wanting to listen to a bit of archive footage. So not until really later on, late 20s, 30s, did people start to record things and think, actually, here we're capturing history. So that's why, yeah.
Well, the presenter was a gentleman named Captain Henry Blythe Thornhill Wakelam.
You're very well briefed.
Oh, good. Yes, yes. Well, listen, I wonder how people received his commentary on the radio. We're so used to hearing sports broadcast on the radio or on TV now. Was it primitive to the audience's ears?
Well, first of all, he did have an abbreviated name. They called him Teddy. We'll call him Teddy. Well, it was much slower. I think that's the first thing. Initially, in the 20s, actually, they used to read the news twice, once at sort of normal speed and secondarily at a much slower pace. Hmm. Because where you were, depending where you were in the UK, you might have good or bad or middling reception. So reception was still a bit of an issue. So sport, which naturally has a sort of pace and a rhythm, that would be, for a modern day ear, would be quite a slow delivery.
Well, you know, 10 years later, Teddy Wakelam is going to make history again, because in 1937, Wimbledon is broadcast on the television. Yeah, for the first time. That must have been even more groundbreaking.
It was. I mean, Wimbledon's a bit like the Olympics, because it was used consistently to trial these new technologies. So you're quite right. It's only 10 years on, and television really is a twinkle in a magician's eye. Very few people had it. It was very, very primitive. And in fact, it launched with a sort of aplomb, and then it stopped during the war years and didn't really resurge until later on in the 40s and the 50s. But radio began, and it was complicated because it was all live and everything was trunked. Television was even more complicated, because you had very little actual equipment available, and that was cumbersome, heavy. You know, you had to maneuver around center court. The Wimbledon authorities were not particularly pleased when these large, bulky machines arrived. So it had all sorts of complexities. And what you saw was, again, to a modern eye, quite primitive because it was restricted by where the television cameras, which were quite big, where they could get in, where they could access the courts.
Well, there is no, as we mentioned, recording of that original broadcast from 1927, but I do want to hear something from the archives here. 1958, Neil Fraser and Ashley Cooper, both Australians, are playing, and the commentary here is by Max Robertson.
He serves the backhand, he comes back cross court. Cooper slips, but gets a forehand half volley back. A whip forehand by Fraser. Cooper gets it back on the volley. A lob tossed high by Fraser. It's short. Cooper a smash. Fraser lobs again deeper. Back goes Cooper, smashes. Fraser again,
so
a forehand.
Very
this time,
fast pace
off.
There. Cooper wins in four sets.
Yeah.
All that to say that Wimbledon seems to have had a historically important role in the BBC's history itself.
Yes, I think it was a constant sort of monument in the sporting fixtures. It was a ritual, you know, and particularly British as well. So it was something that the BBC wanted to have enshrined in its schedule. And first of all, it was early radio. Then it was first of television. The first major sporting fixture was Wimbledon on TV. And then also, and this year, we're also celebrating the 50th anniversary of colour. So and Wimbledon was used as a magnet to get people to buy colour licences, to switch on and buy new television sets. David Attenborough, of course, the very familiar commentator of natural history, was then a controller of BBC Two, and he chose Wimbledon deliberately as a magnet to get people to switch on to new colour TV. And it's phenomenal when you read the responses of the audience, because people actually said things like, "Oh, I can't believe the grass is so green." When, you know, we look around us, the world is in colour, but actually it was an extraordinary thing to see imagery and colour, and particularly sport.
Wow. Robert Cedar is the head of the BBC History and speaking with us on the first day of Wimbledon in 2017. Robert, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
At least the grass wasn't brown. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.